From Virginia to Alaska, Oregon to Michigan, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a number of states are setting up automatic IRA programs to help workers whose employers do not offer a retirement plan. John C. Scott from the Pew Charitable Trust is here with details. Congress will take up a long and controversial agenda this year, including potential action on immigration and maybe even confirmation of a Supreme Court justice. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. People are voting with their feet. Migration trends show folks are leaving states with draconian COVID-19 policies and moving to less restrictive states. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the state and local tax deduction is a big tax cut for the rich. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Many small and medium-sized businesses do not offer retirement plans to their employees, and setting up individual retirement accounts can be daunting. Now, some states are offering auto IRA programs, giving everyone the opportunity to save for retirement. For details, we turn to John C. Scott. John is Project Director for Retirement Savings at the Pew Charitable Trust. John, welcome to American Radio Journal. John, in terms of retirement savings and individual retirement accounts, before we get into the project, the program that the Pew Charitable Trust has been working around the country to develop in the various states, give us a little bit of background. What is the nature of the problem that needs to be resolved here?
Roughly a third to about 40% of the American workforce does not have access to a workplace retirement plan. And so we're really talking tens of millions of Americans who are not saving through a 401k or some other retirement plan that might be offered by their employer. And now, of course, anybody can go online or walk down to their bank and set up an IRA, an individual retirement account. But we know that people don't. Only about 10% of Americans are saving for retirement outside of the workforce. And that's because it's just so much easier. The employer typically offers a nice set of investments to choose from. It's easy to save on a payroll deduction basis. So really, a lot of the work has been taken out of it, which is why the vast majority of retirement savings is done through a workplace retirement plan. Now, the real problem is that when people don't save enough, that they are looking at the prospect of a reduced standard of living in retirement. I think that should be, you know, pretty clear. But in addition, they're also much more likely to need social assistance in old age when they don't have enough savings. So it's not just an issue for the individual who's not saving for retirement, but it's an issue for taxpayers and government because they're looking at an aging population that's not really prepared for retirement. So that's really the nature of the problem.
A number of businesses, particularly ones that are mid-sized to smaller, John, oftentimes just don't have the wherewithal or the time as they're trying to conduct their business to set up these programs. So the solution are the so-called auto IRAs, having nothing to do with automobiles, but automatic. Tell us a little bit about how these auto IRAs work.
This comes from an idea that is really taken from the private sector. A number of larger employers that offer retirement benefits like a 401k plan, they have started over the past 10, 15 years to start automatically enrolling their workers into their retirement plan. In fact, I was automatically enrolled into Pew's retirement plan when I joined 7 years ago. And you have the option to opt out. You can change your contributions at any time. But the idea is to get people into the system and use inertia in their favor, in the sense that they have to do something to opt out of the retirement plan. So what these auto IRAs do is, if you don't have a workplace retirement plan, you are automatically enrolled into a savings program. An IRA is created for you, and it's held at a bank or some other financial institution. and you start saving a set amount, like 5% of your pay, every pay period. And again, much like in the corporate world, you can opt out, you can change your contributions at any time, change your investments. But the idea is to get you to start saving so you get used to it, and you don't really notice the small deduction from your paycheck, and those savings start to build. So that's the basic idea.
Who then administers this and sets up the structure for it, John?
This is the interesting part about it, and I think it's pretty unique. It's a public-private partnership in the sense that in what we're seeing around the country today, it's state governments, but it could be the federal government. But state governments oversee the program. You know, they select the investment managers. They select the plan administrators. They essentially act as the fiduciary to make sure things are done properly. But the IRAs are held by a financial institution. The investment manager is a private firm like BlackRock or Vanguard or Fidelity. And there's an outside plan administrator. It's somewhat analogous. I said it's unique, but it is analogous to what you see in the 529 college savings plans, where the state sort of sponsors or facilitates the program, but it's really run by an outside financial firm.
This is more than just a conceptual idea, correct? There are a number of states around the country that have already set up such programs. Tell us a bit about the experience that those states have had.
There are 10 states that have created these programs. They are, if you'll bear with me, California, Connecticut, Colorado, Maine, Maryland, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, Oregon, and Virginia. And of those 10, three are up and running today, California, Illinois, and Oregon. Oregon was the first program to get started back in 2017. So there's about 4 years of experience in that state. And today, across those three states that have been enrolling workers and people are starting to save, there are approximately 420,000 savers with assets over $375 million. And there are approximately, I want to say, about 20,000 employers that are facilitating the payroll contributions on behalf of those workers. So this is a program that has some experience. And at Pew, we've been very interested in the effects on employers, on workers. And generally, our takeaway from the research has been that while there's still a lot of learning to be done and a lot of experience, these are pretty new, they seem to work for employers, and the workers are saving. Even in the midst of a pandemic, workers continue to save.
Are other states considering these type of programs?
Yes, there are several other states that introduced legislation in 2021. So I think one of the most prominent one would be Pennsylvania, which introduced legislation back in December, just a short bit ago. So there's, and I would say as well, there seems to be bipartisan interest in this legislation. So again, going back to the example of Pennsylvania, but we've seen in a couple of other states, you have a Republican state treasurer and bipartisan sponsorship of legislation. So we would expect that with the start of the new year here, that we'll continue to see legislative activity around the country.
We have been talking with John C. Scott. He is with the Pew Charitable Trust, Project Director for Retirement Savings, talking about auto IRAs. John, tell us a little bit more about Pew, and if folks would like to read and learn more about how these IRAs, individual retirement accounts, will operate, where can they go to get that information?
The Pew Charitable Trust, which is a mouthful, I admit, is a nonprofit research organization. If you want to learn a little bit more about this particular topic, auto IRAs and other retirement-related topics, you can go to Pew Trust, that's PEWTRUST.org/retirement savings, all one string.
John Scott of the Pew Charitable Trust. John, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As we are now into the new year, we're going to take a look at key legislative items that could end up before Congress. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me.
A leftover item before Christmas, Senator Joe Manchin effectively, at least at that point, killed President Joe Biden's so-called Build Back Better bill. Are we going to see the left make another run at it here as Congress reconvenes in the new year?
Well, what the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has actually pledged is to force Joe Manchin and any other senators to go on the record in opposition or support of those key elements of the Build Back Better Act. Whenever you have a reconciliation bill before the United States Senate, they have what's known as a votorama, and that means that there's unlimited number of amendments that are voted on before you proceed to final passage of a reconciliation package. In the past, Republicans use that as an opportunity to force the tough political votes that the Democrats typically want to duck. In this instance, we can actually watch Chuck Schumer flush out the so-called moderates in his Democratic caucus and force them to take positions on things like an extension of the child tax credit expansion from the Biden stimulus last March. They can force votes on free education. They can force votes on free child care. They can force votes on amnesty and immigration, and maybe the Senate parliamentarian will rule some of these provisions to be out of order for a reconciliation package. But what Schumer can do is he can actually force members to come down on the line and put their thumb up or their thumb down. We obviously remember a really famous instance of a thumb going down when Senator John McCain from Arizona voted against the Obamacare repeal, which was actually a partial repeal of the Obamacare law, and something that he wasn't even willing to do as he continued to battle brain cancer. But the bottom line is, reconciliation is an opportunity for Chuck Schumer to force people to take the votes that might be politically damaging to them in later years. It also could be political cover for some of the left-wing progressives that want to tell their base, hey, I supported this. We just couldn't get Joe Manchin or another senator over the line on these various provisions. Do I think that they'll actually make that a lawmaking exercise? I doubt it, just based off the political rhetoric that's been coming out of the White House from senior staff, especially aimed toward Joe Manchin. I think that there's too much bad blood to enact any part of the Build Back Better Act into law for Joe Biden. And I think that the Biden agenda is actually on thin ice in terms of whether or not he's going to become a lame duck president. So what you'll see is Chuck Schumer reevaluating their agenda for 2022. And quite frankly, one thing that he's got to look at are judicial nominations and how to advance that part of the Biden agenda through judicial legacy.
Speaking of judicial nominations, is there the possibility we could see a retirement from the Supreme Court of the United States and possibly a confirmation battle?
I think absolutely. There are a couple of Supreme Court justices, associate justices, that have been around a long time, and there is a building pressure to replace some of these older people with a younger justice that can be around for another generation. And you've also got rumors of health issues for even some of the younger justices, which means you could always have a surprise retirement. How the Supreme Court goes ahead and deals with issues, an issue that typically the Club for Growth doesn't weigh in on, like abortion policy, pro-life policies, whether or not the court weighs in on Roe is going to be very, very massive factor for turnout in the 2022 Senate midterms. And so that's something we also need to keep our eye on. A Supreme Court battle royale, this isn't the same situation that we had with Merrick Garland when Republicans held the United States Senate and Barack Obama was in his last years of power, where Republicans blocked that nomination. Here you've got a situation where Democrats still control the Senate, they control the White House, and they can certainly pass a new Supreme Court justice confirmation within the final months of 2022.
Speaking of those final months of 2022, Scott, there is a strong likelihood that Republicans will regain control of at least the House of Representatives, if not both the House and the Senate. What are we likely to see Democrats do either earlier in the year or if there's a lame duck session? Are they going to try to shove some legislation through before the power changes?
When Democrats had unified government in the Obama administration's term, there was a lot of consternation on how could they not get immigration reform done. And instead of doing immigration reform, you obviously saw Obama prioritize healthcare reform with Obamacare, and then they also did financial reform with Dodd-Frank. Those were the two big items that got done in 2009 and 2010 when Barack Obama had unified government. Republicans had that big wave in the 2010 election where they picked up 63 House seats, and it stalled the rest of the Democrats' ability to get these massive items done. You remember in 2013, they had the Gang of Eight that considered a bipartisan immigration proposal. That, I think, passed the Senate with about 68 votes. But we had a Republican House majority, and John Boehner, to his credit, blocked that legislation from ever being considered. There was never a House vote. But in this situation, in the lame duck session, you still have, in theory, if Joe Manchin doesn't change parties, a 50-50 Senate, and Democrats currently hold the House of Representatives by just a few seats.
We, of course, will continue to track all of these issues as 2022 unfolds with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if anybody wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here. Draconian COVID-19 restrictions are prompting people to leave such states and move to places where there is more individual freedom. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine files this report.
During the first full year of the COVID-19 pandemic, Americans fled from states like California and New York to seek refuge in places with lower taxes and fewer public health restrictions. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a close look at some new data from the Census Bureau that show that 18 states plus Washington, D.C. lost population between July of 2020 and June of 2021, that 12-month period that captures not quite the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, but certainly the bulk of the pandemic starting from last summer through last winter and all the way up through the first half of this year. And the losses sustained by most states, the 18 of them, again, that lost population during that period of time, that's a larger number than we've seen in recent years. But most states only lost a relatively small number of people. The losses sustained by New York and California could, I think, correctly be called something of a mass exodus. New York lost 319,000 residents in that 12-month period, again, from July of 2020 to June of 2021, while California lost 260,000 residents during the same 12 months. Illinois, by the way, ranked third. Now, Illinois has been just sort of hemorrhaging population for several years now. It finished third and lost about 113,000 people. That's roughly in line with what it had been losing in previous years. So even though it's a big number, not the big surge that we saw from places like New York and California. Of course, that could be because a lot of people have already left Illinois. Anyone who may want to get out of Illinois has already done that. When you look at these numbers in a slightly different way, however, you get a little bit of a different story here. When you look at it as a percentage of overall population, there's no place in the country that lost as many people as Washington, D.C., which lost more than 3.4% of its pre-pandemic population in just 12 months. 3.5 out of every 100 people living in D.C. in July of 2020 had left by June of 2021. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, what states are gaining population? If all these people are leaving New York and California and Washington, D.C., they have to be going somewhere. And the big winners are mostly red and purple states in the South. Texas gained 310,000 residents, continuing to grow even faster than it had been in previous years during this last 12-month period. Arizona is up 98,000 residents. North Carolina is up 93,000 residents. Those places all led the way in terms of in-migration from other places. There are many reasons, of course, why someone might choose to move from one place to another, and these are decisions that probably have more to do with individual factors than they do with political or economic issues on a large scale. So I think we should always be a little bit careful about assigning too much meaning to these migration figures. Partisans might want to score points by claiming that Americans are moving from blue states to red states, And look, that is true in broad strokes. That's definitely true. But that also ignores kind of the more nuanced reality here, that people make personal decisions based on reasons that are generally not political, or at least reasons that go beyond, hey, that state was red in the last presidential election, I want to live there. The number one reason why people say they move, and this is true in good times and bad times, is financial pressure. That's according to a study from the Pew Research Center. And it's certainly fair to say that pandemic era policies, and particularly in these blue places, in these heavily blue places like New York City, parts of California, and Washington, D.C., have created a lot of financial pressure for a wide swath of Americans, whether you're a parent, whether you're a business owner, whether you're just an average person who's trying to get by, it's become more difficult. But I suspect that what's also showing up in this census data is something that goes a little bit beyond frustration with pandemic rules and school shutdowns. I think one of the things you're also seeing is a shift towards remote work, towards people having the ability to kind of choose where they want to live rather than being forced to live near where they work. And I think you see this in a couple important places. For example, West Virginia, a state that has been losing population year over year consistently for the past few decades, saw an in-migration increase of more than 2,300 people during the first 12 months of the pandemic. And Delaware, which is similarly kind of close to Washington and Philadelphia, and not necessarily an easy place to commute from, but a place that you could commute from if you were only going into the office, say, one day a week or a couple of times a month. Delaware also saw a huge jump in the number of people moving there. Over the past decade, they've averaged about 5,000 new residents per year. They got more than 12,000 in the last 12 months. West Virginia and Delaware share some other features with those big population-gaining states we talked about before, Texas and Florida and Arizona. Washington and Delaware have low taxes. They have relatively cheap land. And to the extent that remote work is here to stay, places like West Virginia and Delaware stand to be huge winners in this post-pandemic sorting out, where the geography of having lots of states bunched close together, especially on the East Coast, makes for more robust competition. If you only have to go into the office once a week, more people are going to opt to avoid paying the high cost of living and high taxes that come from living in New York City or Washington, D.C. or New Jersey and choose to go somewhere else. Now, of course, lots of people will also stay, even after a year where it lost a huge percentage of its population. 96% of the residents of Washington, D.C. are still residents of Washington, D.C. New York City will always bounce back. It's one of the world's biggest economic engines, and California has kind of boundless natural beauty. There will always be reasons for people to live there as well. But the number of Americans that moved during the pandemic should send a signal to policymakers about some of what's happening on the margins here. Competition between the states is real, and the eventual end of pandemic restrictions won't put an end to that. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the coronavirus pandemic and everything else that's happening in Congress and around the country at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It is known as the state and local tax deduction, or SALT, and it is a way for the wealthy and high property tax states to get a break on their federal taxes. Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
December marked the fourth anniversary of former President Donald Trump signing the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act into law. At the time, supporters of the bill declared it would cut taxes for every American income taxpayer. Opponents of the bill, such as Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, claimed it would only benefit the wealthiest of Americans. Well, who was right? Speaker Pelosi, then the minority leader, even went so far as to call it the quote-unquote billionaire's first tax plan. Unfortunately for her, that statement didn't really age well, as new IRS data released at the end of 2021 showed that those who benefited the most from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act were in fact middle and working class Americans. As it turns out, it really was a plan that put America first. For a major dose of hypocrisy, stay tuned for discussion of the tax provision currently supported by Speaker Pelosi that would actually be a massive tax cut for the rich. You really can't make this up. On the rare occasion that the tax-the-rich crowd agrees to some sort of a tax cut, it's usually promoting gimmicky tax policies like giving special favorites to one company or one industry who is woke enough to be in favor with the left. But the favorite tax cut for the political left today happens to be a provision called the state and local tax deduction, or SALT. The state and local tax deduction allows taxpayers, in many cases wealthy taxpayers, to deduct their state and local tax payments from their federal income tax bill. Federal tax reform in 2017 limited the deduction to $10,000, where previously the SALT deduction was unlimited. Now, the SALT deduction sounds innocuous enough, right? However, it has been called the most sacred of the sacred cows in the federal tax code, and for good reason. Limiting the deduction can mean wealthier Americans in high-tax states like California, New York, Illinois, New Jersey, or maybe even Connecticut, just to name a few, could pay substantially higher tax bills. The SALT deduction is a clever method utilized by the tax and spend states to get the rest of America to subsidize their choices of being big government states. This unfairness and incentive for states to overtax and overspend is likely why President Ronald Reagan called addressing the SALT deduction his unfinished business from the historic Reagan tax reforms of the 1980s. Of course, you can't fault wealthy individuals in high-tax states for trying to reduce their tax burdens, but as we consider the political incentives at play, the federal SALT deduction actually incentivizes states to have higher tax rates. It would be much more honest to have a discussion in each state capital about how taxpayers want their taxes spent and how high those taxes should be. If residents of a state want big government and high taxes, of course, that's their choice, but they should be required to pay for it directly. Under President Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan, which has recently run into political headwinds but is likely to be brought back in the future, the SALT deduction cap would be raised from the current $10,000 to a whopping $80,000. The claim is that it would allow middle and working class Americans to deduct more from their taxes every year. But the truth is that most Americans don't even pay $10,000 in state and local taxes annually, let alone $80,000. If done correctly, a full elimination of the state and local tax deduction could help return the United States to a more robust national economic growth, which is what states and taxpayers desperately need today. Using the revenue generated from ending the SALT deduction, Congress would have ample resources to significantly reduce income tax rates, helping all taxpayers keep more of their hard-earned tax money. While it's refreshing to see big government types like Speaker Nancy Pelosi at least talk about the need to reduce taxes, ramping up the SALT deduction and subsidizing high-tax states is exactly the worst way to do so. To help fuel real economic opportunity, providing tax cuts for all hardworking taxpayers is the best answer. For more information on the state and local tax deduction and how ideas in the Build Back Better plan affect the states, you can visit www.alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KJZK-FM in Kingman, Boulder City, Arizona, KXRA-AM in Alexandria, Minnesota, along with KAYQ-FM in Warsaw, Missouri. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.